Ladies and gentlemen, this program is called That Reminds Me, and I'm Clement Freud. Thank you. When you get to a certain age, like 76 years and 10 months in my case, That Reminds Me is preferable to Let Me Tell You Exactly How It Was. I'm known, as far as I'm known, as the grandson of a famous grandfather, as a cook, as a politician, or should I say a member of parliament, as a sometime presenter of a dog food commercial, which I now wish I hadn't done. And you know, the fact that I think of myself as a family man and a gambler, a journalist, will come as a surprise to all those who don't come from my family, listen to Radio 4, or are my bookmakers. Let's start with That Reminds Me about my grandfather. Until I was about 8 years old, we didn't live in the same country. And after that age, my father used to take me to Vienna to see my famous grandfather, who had cancer of the mouth and whom I never knew when he was other than in pain. But he was, to me, not famous, but to me a good grandfather, in that he didn't forget my birthdays. And when I visited him, I remember there was one occasion when he and his chow and I went for a walk in Vienna. And there was a sort of commotion, and a man was lying on the pavement, having a fit, and his hat had fallen from his head. And people came forward, embarrassed, and put small sums of money in his hat. If I'd been with my nanny, she would have covered my eyes and shoved me out of the way. And my grandfather simply held my hand, and we stood there and we watched for about a minute. And then he turned away. And I said to him, why didn't we give him any money? And he looked at me and said, he didn't do it well enough. So he had every right to go on and become a famous grandfather as well as a dear grandfather. I was, for 6 years, rector of the University of Dundee. As rector of the university, you would chair the court of the university. And there was one occasion in which a physics graduate came to me, well, to us, the court of the university, with a complaint. He had, in the course of his final physics examination, been asked a question. And the question had been, how would you gauge the height of a skyscraper using a barometer? He had replied that he would take the barometer to the top of the skyscraper. He would tie to it a piece of string and lower it. When the barometer touched the ground, he would measure the elapsed string, add to it the length of the barometer, and that would be the height of the skyscraper. And he was failed for showing a total ignorance of physics. He appealed to us, the court of the university, on the grounds that he had been asked a question, given a correct answer, and received no credit for it. And the marks were important to the quality of his degree. And we considered, and we thought, yes, he'd had a point, and we appointed an external examiner to ask that question again. And when the graduate appeared before the examiner said, well, you had plenty of time to think about it, now what's your answer? The graduate said, it isn't as simple as that. He said, I could, I suppose, go to the top of the skyscraper and drop the barometer. And with an accurate stopwatch, I could time the number of seconds it took for the barometer to hit the ground, and then, bearing in mind that G equals 32 feet per second per second, I give you a pretty good idea of the height of the building, or, and this may well have been what you had in mind, I could take the barometric pressure at the top of the building and then again at the bottom. But on consideration, what I think I would do would be to go to the janitor and say, if you will tell me the height of the skyscraper, I will give you a barometer. I started my working life as a cook at the Dorchester. This was in no way a vocation. My father was an architect. War had broken out. My father had no work because there was no building during the war. And he had two sons at university, planted an aunt at the Dorchester who persuaded the general manager to give me a job as an apprentice cook. I received 10 shillings a week for a 48-hour week. So if you translate that into modern-day figures, about £15 a week. What I noticed, what has changed most significantly between 1940 and the 60 intervening years, is that in my day, if you worked in a hotel, there was us, which was us, and there was them, which was the others, the customers. And nothing that we could do to them was bad enough. I remember after I'd been there for about a week, a commis chef, I was an apprentice, and the commis was the next one up, urinated into the stock pot. I said, "Why are you doing that, chef?" And he said, "That'll teach them, rich bastards." And this was very much the attitude. Anything beastly you could do was a sort of point for us. I cooked for over a year at the Dorchester, and I learnt pretty well nothing. I mean, for 5 days, I made pomme olivette. You get a spoon which has an olive-shaped cutting edge, and for 600 people, you spend day upon day cutting out olivette potatoes, getting sores on your forefinger of your right hand and in your palm. And when you've done that and are looking forward to something really interesting, you wash spinach for 2 days. What you learn as an apprentice chef is the algebra of cooking. This plus that equals that. And that's enormously important. I was able to read cookery books the way musicians read musical scores. I can read a cookery book and say, "That's wonderful," or "That doesn't work." And that's pretty helpful. My next catering job was after I came out of the army. I, as one did in those days, and the war was on, the age of 17, I volunteered for the Air Force, then for the Navy, and was then called up into the army. I'm pleased to be here in Scotland because I began my military career fighting for you at Maryhill Barracks in Glasgow. Mostly behind public houses at closing time. And I spent 2.5 years of war and then 2.5 years of peace, at the end of which I was liaison officer in Nuremberg for the war crimes trials. And I drank. Seemed to me no other way of putting up with the war crimes trials, in which in many cases we were introducing legislation which was not on the statute book. And you know, wars since time immemorial, the victorious army raped the women, shot the men, and went on their business. And in Nuremberg, we made up laws and which went on the statute book. And I drank. Geoffrey Barnard put an advertisement in the personal column of the Daily Telegraph some many years ago and said, "I, Geoffrey Barnard, have been asked by Lord Weidenfeld to write my autobiography. If anyone knows what I was doing between 1956 and 1979, I would very much like to hear from you." I was demobilized in 1947 in Chester. I was allowed to choose a demob suit and picked one which didn't fit and took a taxi from Chester to Plymouth because Plymouth Argyle was my team. And I then spent some time sobering up, like the next 50 years. I started gambling, which is an important part of my life, when I was 8 years old at Dartington Hall. I hadn't pocket money because I didn't come from the sort of family who gave pocket money. My mother had somehow acquired a friend who was a doctor, a pediatrician, who maintained that children should be starved. It was really good for children not to eat anything. All the troubles that came to children was because they ate. And so I was very hungry for a very long time. And I suppose pocket money would have, allowed me to buy a Milky Way. So I got sixpence a week pocket money at Dartington. And on Saturdays we had a roulette school. And the maximum we were allowed to put on a number was a halfpenny. But, you know, a halfpenny times 35 was 1 5-pence halfpenny, not money to be sneezed at. So I became quite keen on gambling, and lessons at Dartington were optional. It was an enlightened co-educational school. And I didn't go to lessons much. A man called David Leach, whose father was Bernard Leach, had a pottery. And I was a very small boy. And I was allowed to make spouts for teapots at 4 pence an hour. And if you have very small fingers, as I then did, you made spouts with some skill. And I used the 4 pence an hour to buy cider, which cost 11 pence halfpenny a flagon. So my years of darting had me not only as a gambler, but as an illiterate drunk as well. People come to me and say, why didn't you send your children to Dartington? I left Dartington because all my heroes, I read The Hotspur, Skipper, Wizard, Adventure, Rover, and Triumph, made good and went to Africa and sold bicycles. And I realized that if I stayed at Dartington, I wouldn't be able to work out the price of 2 bicycles, let alone 3 or 4, which my heroes sold. And I went to a very proper prep school, and I did one thing at Dartington which was useful. I had a house mother whom I loved a bit, and there was an election in, I suppose, 1934. And I said, whom should I vote for? And she said, the Liberals. And so I joined the Liberal Party at the age of 10, which some 38 years later stood me in awfully good stead. I'm looking at my watch, not so much because it's 25 past 11, which is not without interest, but my grandfather on his deathbed sold me this watch. When I came out of the army, I thought I would go back into catering, and I heard of a vacancy in a hotel in Cannes, in the south of France. I'm going to read you a piece from a book in which I wrote about this incident. When I was 23 years old, I went to the south of France to continue my catering apprenticeship at an hotel in Cannes. And the managing director, who was very busy and spoke French very quickly, asked to see me, shook my hand, bade me sit down, told me he hoped that I'd be content, and that as a gesture to international cooperation between our countries, I should drink a liter of wine per week with my meals, with his compliments, and good luck, goodbye. He got up, I got up, and I didn't see him again for months. As I explained, he spoke French rather quickly, and I missed the per week bit. And I hadn't at that time gone metric and was surprised when I ordered a liter of wine with my first lunch at the size of the bottle. My colleagues looked on admiringly as I did my best for the old entente and finished it within the half-hour lunch break. That night I had another liter, and the next lunch, and the next evening. In those first weeks in Cannes, I became captain of the hotel football team, although I played rugby. Bought a second-hand motorbike with sidecar, which I had no license to drive. Proposed marriage to several customers and the housekeeper, who was 58. And on my 24th birthday, won a substantial sum of money playing number 24 in the casino. And throughout that time, I moved in the oyster light of an alcoholic haze, mistook customers for each other, gave people the wrong keys, the wrong messages, the wrong bills, and quite often fell asleep behind the reception desk. But I never let down that generous managing director. That liter of wine was drunk twice a day, and on my day off, I had lunch or dinner out and returned to the hotel to claim my tipple. At the end of the month, I saw the managing director for the second time. He said, and he now spoke more slowly, or perhaps I understood him better, that the reports he had received about me were less than totally satisfactory. "It appears," he said, "that you drink." "Only," I answered, "what you so kindly asked me to." "But you drink 2 litres a day," he said, looking at his notes. "With your compliments," I said, belching gently, trying to get him into focus. "I offered you 1 litre a week." There wasn't a lot I could say. My casino winnings went to pay my wine bills, and Cannes took on an entirely new appearance, not just because it was spring, but customers emerged from their cocoons of anonymity, keys achieved an identity, the croisette outside remained static when it had previously refused to settle down, and my eyes returned to the colour specified in my passport, signed by Mr. Ernest Bevin. I left the South France and became manager of a seasonal hotel in North Devon. We had in this hotel a rather upmarket customer who arrived with his wife and children and nanny and chauffeur. And in mid-June, he came to me and said, "Freud, do you have a bookmaker?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Here's £100. Put it on Benny Lynch to win the Ascot Gold Cup at 100-1. Now, the great usefulness of knowing about gambling and racing was also to know that Benny Lynch, who belonged to Lord Derby, was the pacemaker for Elicidon, who was the favourite to win the Gold Cup. And pacemakers don't win, and horses at 100-1 don't win. He gave me these wonderfully large, white, crinkly notes, and £100 was over 6 weeks' pay, and I put in my pocket, said, "Leave it to me, sir." This was in the pre-television age, and I listened to the Ascot Gold Cup on the radio, 1949. And Raymond Glendenning was the commentator. He said the horses are under starter's orders, off, and Benny Lynch took the lead, as pacemakers do. And after a mile, Benny Lynch was still well in the lead and demanded a quarter. Glendenning said, "He's now so far in the lead, I doubt anyone will catch him." £100 at 100-1 is £10,000. It was 15 years of my pay. It would have bought 250 acres of prime Suffolk farming land. With half a mile to go, Benny Lynch was still in the lead, and Glendenning was optimistic about the pacemaker doing it. I don't think I've ever suffered as much. I actually felt ice-cold sweat on the back of my neck. And Elicidon did win, and the £100 I had, I was so ashamed of having that I gave most of them away. I've never since been a bookmaker. I've never stuck a bet again. In 1952, I opened a nightclub in Sloane Square. I had very little money, but the people who owned the theatre in Sloane Square needed whatever, and I paid weekly in advance. And in the beginning, I did 12 people's jobs and probably got 3 people's pay. I was my own chef, and I used a cook who'd been elsewhere. I didn't open till 10 o'clock at night. I was my own wine buyer, my own cellarman, my own wine waiter, my own head waiter, my own cashier, bouncer. You name it, I did it. And after I'd run the nightclub for about a year, I decided to have a cabaret. And because I only paid £10 a week for the whole cabaret act, I employed people who'd never worked anywhere else before, and I was the first person to employ Jonathan Miller, David Frost, Rolf Harris, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Lance Percival, and lots of people you've never heard of. And I haven't heard of again. Rolf Harris worked in cabaret for me, and I thought I will tell an Australian joke. It's about an Australian who went into Fortnum and Mason's and said, "I would like to buy an avocado pear." And this elegantly morning-coated salesman said, "An avocado pear, certainly, sir, that would be £2.17.6. The Australian said, "You know what you can do with that avocado pear?" And the salesman said, "I'm very sorry, sir. I'm already accommodating a pineapple at 6 guineas. In 1972, the sitting Member of Parliament for the Isle of Ely died, and there was a by-election. And I thought it would be a good thing for me to do. The House of Commons has a non-smoking chamber, and I was getting increasingly allergic to smoke. And there were a number of other reasons why I wanted to be an MP. I wrote to the chairman of the Isle of Ely Liberal Association and said I would like to stand, and I have sufficient money not to embarrass them financially and would pay my own expenses. I was put on a short list with two other people, and one Sunday had to appear at the Griffin Hotel in March with the two other candidates before the assembled might of the Isle of Ely Liberal Association. The history of the Isle of Ely, quite simply, was that in 1966 the Liberal lost its deposit. In 1970 it was a straight fight between Conservative and Labour, so the Liberals were not exactly likely to win. There were 21 people at the Griffin Hotel in March, and I found out later that eight of them were the might of the Liberal Party. Embarrassed at the small number that turned out, they went to the old people's home across the road and got 13 people to reinforce the audience. The man before me was in for an hour and a quarter. I was in being interviewed, and after 10 minutes I was told, thank you very much. And I waited for the third man, and after an hour and a half he was still in there. And I thought, fine, and I drove home. And the next day the chairman of the Isle of Ely Liberal Association phoned me up and said, you didn't wait for the vote. And I said, no, I didn't. He said, would you be surprised to learn that you won? And I said, well, yes, frankly. By what did I win? And he said, by 13 votes to 8. I went to an estate agent to get an office, and I didn't realize the estate agent was chairman of the Conservative Party. So I didn't get an office for a while, but it was a fascinating election. The bookmakers made me 33-1. The Conservative was 6-1 on, Labour was 9-2. And at 33-1, you're just in a three-horse race. You're not a credible candidate. The Conservative actually said, I welcome the jocular irrelevance of Mr. Freud's candidature. I put a substantial sum of money on myself at 33-1. As a consequence, the Daily Telegraph wrote that in the Isle of Ely election, the clever money seems to be going on Freud. It was actually the Freud money which was going on. Anyway, I won the election, won a lot of money. Historically, if you win an election away from the sitting party at a by-election, your chances of retaining the seat are less than 4%. I was determined to retain my seat. I spent the week writing letters to my constituents. I took the Wisbech Standard, the Whittlesea Gazette, the Ely Evening Post, the Littleport Chronicle, the March Advertiser. I think that was about the extent of it. And everyone whose name was mentioned in any capacity got a letter from me. Well, you paid the postage because it was done on official House of Commons mail. But if somebody died, I wrote to say how sorry I was and if I could help not to fail to contact me. If somebody was born, I wrote to father and mother congratulating them. If someone was promoted, they got a letter welcoming them. If someone was demoted, I sent them a letter of commiseration. I wrote to football teams that won and cricket teams that lost, golf teams that were disqualified, badminton teams that didn't turn up. And that was 5 days a week, and then the weekend I was in my constituency being seen, and people would come up to me and say, I got your letter. And of course I had no idea who they were. And in the beginning I said, remind me. And their faces fell. And they said, you mean you don't remember the people you write letters to? But when I said, oh, good, the man said, well, she's dead. It took me months to find a reply to I got your letter when you didn't know who they were. The answer is, it was the least I could do. (Laughter) I was a popular MP in that my predecessor only had one after-dinner joke, and they were really ready for someone else. I was also fascinated by the work of Parliament, although much more fascinated by the work of a constituency MP. I had surgeries in 11 places every month because there wasn't much transport. I had a man who came in and said, I'm a member of M15. I had a man who came to me and said, I need your help, I'm in trouble. I said, well, do what I can. He said, I was caught by the police, I put Green Shield stamps on my National Health Insurance card. I said, what will happen? And I was able to help him. I said, listen, there are two alternatives. Either you will go to prison for 3 months, or you will get an electric toaster. I had a colleague in Parliament called Jeff Dickins, who was perhaps not as fortunate. He went to a garden fete in his constituency, and a rather dotty lady kept coming up to him, and his agent and his secretary diverted him so that the confrontation didn't take place. On the Tuesday after that Saturday garden fete, he found a letter on his desk which said, Dear Mr. Dickens, I'm a tremendous fan of yours. I tried to attract your attention at the garden fete, but you somehow seem to miss me. I would be so grateful if you would send me a signed photograph. Yours sincerely, E. Johnson, brackets, horse face. And he was so touched by a woman's appreciation of her debilities that he got his very nicest, shiniest photograph and wrote, To horse face with good wishes, Geoffrey Dickens. And the next day, his secretary came in and said, did you get that letter from the funny woman at the garden fete? I put horseface after her name so you would know who she was. Ladies and gentlemen of Edinburgh, let me remind you that that is the end of the program. Thank you.